The newspaper industry must recognize that much of its past is mirrored in the present and future.
Today, in Section A of this two-part series on arts and letters, we'll be talking with journalist, researcher, and professor Donna Lampkin-Stevens. Her book, If It Ain't Broke, Break It, How Corporate Journalism Killed the Arkansas Gazette, published by the University of Arkansas Press in 2015, offers an account of the history of the Arkansas Gazette, then the oldest newspaper west of the Mississippi River.
And even if its responses to previous challenges were wrong, the knowledge of those responses and ensuing results can help inform the tactics used in the battles of today and tomorrow.
If It Ain't Broke, Break It, with Donna Lampkin-Stevens on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, in Section A of this two-part series, we'll be talking with Donna Lampkin-Stevens about the history of the Arkansas Gazette, a newspaper founded by William E. Woodruff in 1819, 17 years before Arkansas became a state.
This road is narrow, babe, and it's longer than I know. A heavy bleeding, I say, I won't make it through.
The paper passed through a succession of eight different owners during the first 83 years of its life before the high school family of Tennessee bought it.
To take us into the newsroom and help us to understand what happened to the Arkansas Gazette, Donna Lampkin-Stevens, professor, producer, journalist. Welcome.
Thank you, Brad. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about the Arkansas Gazette.
Tell us a little bit about your history. You were a journalist.
I worked at the Arkansas Gazette, and I guess, full disclosure, we should put that in here.
Right.
I came to the Arkansas Gazette as an intern in the summer of 1984 in the sports department. So I was a sports writer. Summer of 1984, went back and finished my degree at the University of Arkansas, came back to the Gazette for $4 an hour, again, after I graduated with my degree in 1985, and worked there until the day the doors closed.
Let's begin on page one. The terms of the Arkansas Gazette, first published on November 20, 1819, by founder William E. Woodruff, were as follows.
This paper is published weekly on Saturdays at $3 per annum if paid in advance or your dollars payable at the end of the year.
So there's a picture of the November 1819 first copy ever of the Gazette in your book. What was the first iteration of the Gazette like?
Well, it certainly wouldn't fly today. No photographs, tiny type, dense columns. Certainly not what we would call reader-friendly. But there was foreign and national news borrowed from other papers. Some, incidentally, dated July. And remember, the Gazette was born on November 20th, so that shows the lag in getting the information out. As well as some other things we see today in newspapers, such as letters to the editor, marriage and death notices, retail advertising, and even what today we would call classifieds. There's a poetry section, believe it or not.
The paper was bought in June of 1902 by Carrick White High School, a Memphis judge who partnered with his two sons, John Netherland, J.N., and Fred, along with the Gazette's business manager, Frederick W. Alsop, to buy controlling interest.
This was what I call the first triumvirate, the two high school brothers, J.N. and Fred, who, along with Alsop, saw to the day-to-day management of the paper. Judge High School remained an interested partner in Memphis. The high school brothers had similar core values and believed that a newspaper should not be considered a property, but instead an institution. Thus, they believed strongly in a free press and in shining light on problems so that public attention could solve them. In short, they believed a newspaper should serve as the conscience of its community. Mr. High School was a real cheerleader for Arkansas. He came in and he embraced his adopted hometown. And this shows later in his battles with Governor Jeff Davis. He thought that Arkansas was hurt by some of the stereotypes that were going around the country at that time about the state. And he wanted to prove that wrong for the betterment of his adopted hometown and state. Jeff Davis was governor in 1902 when the high schools came. And a couple of years later, he was running for re-election. And, you know, quality journalism part of that is required that you stand up against something that was bad or wrong for the community.
Well, I've been up all night.
And I think you could not find two more opposite people than Governor Jeff Davis and Mr. High School. Jeff Davis was a divisive figure who turned to racial demagoguery.
And what a terrible sight.
He called the Gazette that old red harlot and added, I had rather be caught with a dead buzzard under my arm or a dead polecat. Can you believe this?
Thinking about how you roll.
Why was he so upset?
Because the Gazette had criticized him. And he actually called, he said that the Gazette was a Republican newspaper, which just enraged Mr. High School at that time, and then the battle was on. The Gazette's editorial page carried regular criticisms of the governor's policies, and the feelings were mutual. I guess Davis once told a crowd that if his young son turned out to be above average in intelligence, he hoped he would become a minister. If he turned out to be average, he hoped to make him a lawyer. But if he's a complete idiot, he said, a man who just doesn't have any judgment about anything, God help us, I'm going to send him up to Little Rock to be the editor of the Arkansas Gazette. Now, isn't that great for a politician and a newspaper man to go at it like that? Davis was later elected to the United States Senate, where the Gazette's opposition followed him. And Mr. High School had obviously been opposing him for many years. And in a delicious twist of irony that you could not even make up, after he died in office, Mr. High School was appointed to fill his U.S. Senate seat until a successor was elected.
The Gazette tried very hard to be fair, but also it pointed to inadequacies and
problems
and wasn't afraid to do it. So,
no.
For instance, they would criticize the police in bold type.
Yes, yes, because that was part of what a good newspaper should do, be a leader in the community. In 1927, John Carter, a black man in Little Rock, was accused of assaulting a white woman and her daughter. An angry mob lynched him, then dragged the body around the streets of the city and burned it. Terrible, terrible incident. It was one of the most notorious incidents of racial violence in Arkansas history. The Gazette's front page headline read, "With officers making no attempt at restraint, mob burns Negro's body and creates reign of terror." Now, that's pretty forceful. But there was also a front page editorial by Mr. High School that criticized the police and called on them to take control of the situation. We cannot live in an unorderly community like this.
As with every family business, grief and personal tragedy entered the picture.
Yes. On March 31st, 1931, the first of the original triumvirate, Fred High School, JN's beloved younger brother, died of a heart attack. He was only 55 years old.
I feel so alone without you here.
So what kind of a blow was this to the triumvirate?
It was terrible. And actually, Fred High School had been the one who was much, much beloved by the employees of the Arkansas Gazette. It's said that when Fred died, almost everyone in the newsroom owed him money.
It gets so cold in Arkansas this time of year.
Because he had loaned money over the years, and JN High School forgave all those debts after Fred's death. So that tells you a little bit about the way the high school brothers treated their employees. Remember, this was before retirement programs, and many people just retained a salary at the Arkansas Gazette even when they became too old to work because the high school family believed in taking care of their employees.
Time can heal a broken heart. Time can heal a broken heart. Time can heal a broken heart. Time can heal a broken heart.
Then on November 21st, 1943, Carrick High School, JN High School's son, who was to have been his heir to take over the Gazette, died during his World War II service while piloting an Army transport plane between India and China. In 1942, while training in Waco, Texas, before he went overseas, Carrick wrote the following letter home as a Christmas present to his family. My greatest regret is that I will not be there at home to celebrate Christmas with you. But then there are millions of others in the same situation, and we are all in this thing together. My Christmas present for you is still in the future. Someday, I and thousands of others like me will be able to give you a peaceful world again where we can all live our own lives in freedom and happiness. And it will come to pass soon. We are right and cannot fail. After his death, there was a great outpouring of grief. In the newspaper itself, many letters of condolence came in, but also just editorials and columns and sad notes of sympathy to Mr. Highschool. And this death really, I mean, I think it couldn't help but break the old man's heart.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to Donna Lampkin Stevens as she talks about the history of the Arkansas Gazette.
J.N. Highschool, at 73 years old, was left to look to the future of his paper alone. By the end of the war, he was forced to reassess his plans for the future of the oldest newspaper west of the Mississippi River. A new triumvirate would build on the legacy of fairness and community spirit and lead the state through its most notorious crisis.
So the family had no direct male heir. And while the men were off to war, J.N. Highschool's older daughter, Elizabeth, had worked on the Gazette's editorial page. She wanted to remain in some capacity after the war, but he wouldn't let her.
No, isn't that kind of sad, too? That was not to be under Mr. Highschool. He was a genteel gentleman. He wanted educated daughters, but his other daughter, Louise, told someone later that he didn't want them to do anything with their education. So Hugh Patterson, Louise Highschool's husband, was named advertising manager in 1946. He did not have a journalism background. He had a graphic arts background. And so Mr. Highschool was still looking for someone to come on to essentially take young Carrick's place as editor. And he found Harry Scott Ashmore, who was editor of the editorial page of the Charlotte, North Carolina News, at a convention, heard him make a speech, and he made him an offer, and then Harry Ashmore moved to Little Rock and became editor of the editorial page in 1947. And in 1948, he was named executive editor.
What belief systems did the new triumvirate bring to the Gazette?
Well, we still had Mr. Highschool, right, who had all of his strong beliefs in what a newspaper should be. But there was a generational gap. Mr. Highschool was born in the South during Reconstruction. His father had served as a colonel in the 19th Tennessee Infantry Regiment during the Civil War. Now, during World War II, Hugh Patterson and Harry Ashmore had served, like many other returning servicemen after their years fighting the Nazis, they came home and began to question things such as segregation. And I think it's fair to say that the two younger soldiers, Harry and Hugh, were more naturally progressive than Mr. Highschool.
Highschool hired Harvard-educated Harry Ashmore just as race was becoming a defining issue of our time.
Really, Brad, it was a place of the right time and the right place. Perfect confluence.
Left my friends, left all my ties. I would have left them all a trillion times in my mind. Take the pictures off the walls. All the black and white and big and small.
Harry Ashmore had a reputation as a moderate to liberal thinker, especially on the race issue. And after he returned from World War II, he apparently spent a weekend devouring Gunnar Myrdal's 1944 book, An American Dilemma, about the American race issue. And Ashmore felt that the South needed to change with the changing times or face change being forced on it from without, which we had seen in the Civil War. So he really thought that race was going to be one of the defining issues of the next few years when he got back from the war. And he thought he could make a difference if he landed in the right place. And I think history tells us that he certainly landed in the right place to make a difference.
Won't you come and see me now? Won't you come on down south?
So you write, quote, Ashmore and Highschool's first conversation on race involved using courtesy titles for blacks. What does that mean?
Well, previously, Gazette style, like most papers in the South, had been to use courtesy titles like Mr., Mrs., Miss in front of a last name. Those were used for white people, but not for black people. And Ashmore got Mr. High School to modify that policy so that the Gazette style became to use courtesy titles for all women, regardless of race, and to drop them for all men, regardless of race, except for a few exceptions such as the president, the governor, clergy, and the dead.
Okay, so set this up for us because there's a big confluence of events
yes.
that happened around 1954. First, we have Harry Ashmore, who's pretty liberal, promoting certain causes and belief systems. Mm-hmm. And then,
although he was a Southerner, he had deep Southern roots in South Carolina. So that gave him a little more credibility
right.
in the South to be forcing these kinds of things.
Then you have a foil who appears
yes.
in the guise of Orville Faubus, who is a relative newcomer to Arkansas politics, comes down from the hills of Madison County to plunk down his fee on the final day of filing to run against Democratic Governor Francis Cherry.
Ashmore actually wound up writing a tear-jerking radio speech for Faubus that secured his election. So this is sort of complicated. Let's go through this. Orville Faubus, in 1954, ran as a liberal. He attacked Governor Cherry's record on welfare. Now, let's back up. Orville Faubus's father was a card-carrying member of the Socialist Party. Orville Faubus went not to the University of Arkansas, which was in his backyard from Huntsville, but he went for a period of time to Commonwealth College, which was really a socialist institution of higher education in MENA. 1954, the governor's race was a very nip-and-tuck affair, the Democratic primary, until Cherry's people intimated that, based on this attendance at Commonwealth College, that Orville was a communist. And Harry Ashmore thought it was terribly unfair to bring that up so many years later, and certainly by that point, Orville Faubus was nothing like a communist. But it was also the era of McCarthyism and that kind of stuff in the country. So Harry Ashmore and several other community leaders leapt to Faubus' defense.
Well, I'm glad to be back home. Yes, I'm glad to be back home. Well, I'm glad to be back home.
Now, that's one way journalism has changed. We wouldn't have a newspaper editor working for a candidate for governor in these days. But these men got together. They said, you know, you've got to make a speech. Let's do a speech that just claimed that it was just a youthful mistake, that you didn't know what you were getting into when you went to Commonwealth College. And so they got together, and Harry was the wordsmith, so he wrote the speech. And the speech was credited with turning the race around in Faubus's favor, and it wound up putting him in the governor's mansion, and then we know what happened later. Now, we need to be clear, Governor Faubus did initiate several progressive accomplishments during his tenure, including improvements in public education, the establishment of the Arkansas Children's Colony, which was the first institution for underdeveloped children, the expansion of state parks, and the paving of hundreds of miles of highways. But certainly all that was lost in the aftermath of 1957 in Central High.
Some say hope's a curse no longer sweet. Faith is absent, life shattered on Main Street. Nothing's different, watch the news any day. It's still a world ruled by fear and pain.
As a borderline southern state, Arkansas had appeared ready for a gradual desegregation of its largest school district leading up to the 1957-58 school year. What stance did the Gazette take on the crisis?
Well, the Gazette, under the second triumvirate, Mr. High School, Harry Ashmore, and Hugh Patterson, was one of a handful of southern newspapers that advocated moderation, tolerance, obedience to federal law during this crisis, and also the ensuing civil rights movement.
Many lost outside themselves looking in, searching for a solution they can never win. Try to run, but but we are so small. There's a few before we can roam.
While many people interpreted the Gazette's stance as advocating desegregation, that is not technically true. Now, Harry Ashmore and Hugh Patterson, they couched it in terms of, this is a state versus federal government issue. We know what's going to happen if the state defies the federal government. We had to abide by the federal law. The federal law was supreme over the state law.
But I'm waiting for a brighter day. And I'm praying for a better way. And I'm walking through the valley. We can change.
The Gazette was awarded two Pulitzer Prizes on May 5, 1958. The gold medal for disinterested and meritorious public service went to the newspaper for, quote, demonstrating the highest qualities of civic leadership, journalistic responsibility, and moral courage in the face of mounting public tension during the school integration crisis in 1957.
And that was the first time that any American newspaper had won two Pulitzer Prizes for coverage of the same event in any one year. Quite a historic accomplishment. Now, Central High had taken its toll on the Gazette. The high school family lost the equivalent of $13 million. I mean, imagine that. But eventually, the state moved toward that more progressive future with Jay in high school still at the helm of the Gazette.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Donna Lampkin-Stevens about the history of the Arkansas Gazette.
The post-World War II years were generally a period of growth for American newspapers. And after the vestiges of the Central High crisis passed, the Gazette was probably healthier than most as it continued to grow despite the increasing competition from television and the national trend toward urbanization of newspapers.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
Wayne Jordan, a longtime Arkansas Gazette reporter, said that after originally supporting the United States government's involvement in Vietnam, the Gazette ultimately switched sides and editorialized against the war.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
With the 1968 assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Robert F. Kennedy adding to the nation's ongoing unrest, the Gazette continued to advocate unpopular stances, supporting school consolidation in Pulaski County and editorializing against Governor Orville Faubus and even President Richard Nixon.
So let's just talk about the late 60s just a little bit. So they took a pretty big hit in 57 and 58, but they continued to take strong stance.
Now, Harry Ashmore left a year or two after Central High. He thought that the Gazette could recover more easily if he were gone. He sort of became the target. But Mr. High School hired James O. Powell to replace Harry Ashmore, and James O. Powell was able to really be a liberal in Little Rock, in Arkansas, in the late 1960s. As the years went by, the Gazette was able to come out and really be more liberal and say that segregation was wrong on its face, not because it was the federal law, but because it was the right thing to do.
On November 2nd, 1972, Mr. High School turned 100. By that time, the Gazette was easily the dominant newspaper in Arkansas.
With much to celebrate, the high school family threw a centennial birthday celebration for its patriarch at the Country Club of Little Rock. More than 750 people greeted the old man.
Take down the sky and unravel it.
The guest list included four generations of his family, Harry Ashmore, Senator J. William Fulbright, Governor Dale Bumpers, bankers, attorneys, businessmen, state and national leaders, as well as every employee of the Arkansas Gazette. I find that very telling as well. I mean, I saw the invitation in my research. We want every employee of the Arkansas Gazette to come to Mr. High School's birthday party. And, you know, they didn't have to do that.
The day after Christmas, Jay in high school went to the hospital for the second time since his birthday, and he died at 12:15 p.m. on December 28, 1972.
There's a cartoon that I wanted to get in the book, but I wasn't able to get it. But I believe it was George Fisher drew a cartoon, and it had the masthead of the Arkansas Gazette and Mr. High School with his cane walking up it to heaven.
He said, newspapers are human institutions, not perfect and not godlike. What do you make of that comment?
It's a reflection of how he was, I think. He had always believed that you tried your best, and I think he would admit that he made some mistakes. He probably knew that as he got older that the American society had passed him by. He was from a different era, and by 1972, certainly things had changed in his lifetime, and I just think that he wanted his newspaper to make a difference. He wanted to make a difference. JN High School made a difference in the community in Little Rock. He was a big advocate for the public library. In the days of separate but equal, which was never equal.
Even at 100, he remained true to his philosophy that he wrote in 1952. What was that?
He said this was a speech that he made on the 50th anniversary of his years as editor of the Arkansas Gazette. The man responsible for the destiny of a newspaper must make daily accounting to his community and to his own conscience. And at last he will have written the record of his stewardship, and he must make a final accounting. He cannot use as a means of measurement the financial success he has had, or the size of circulation or volume of advertising. It is as if he entered the confines of a tribunal where sat judges, stern in judgment, but just and righteous and tolerant within the bounds of conscience and duty. The one question is whether he must be adjudged guilty of default on his obligation to a community and betrayal of his mission and his opportunity, or whether he can look his judges in the eye and ask discharge from his labors with the words, I have fought a good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith.
We
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1 about the history of the Arkansas Gazette. Be sure to tune in to part two when we talk about the paper's final years. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you thought about the program. Thank you to singers and songwriters Shannon McClung.
All the way home. All the way home.
Stephen Winter. Blues Boy Jag.
Well, I've been up all night.
The Uh-huhs, Trent Whitehead and Zach Hale. Anna Jordan and Bill Benson.
Some say hope's a curse no longer sweet.
And Ramona Smith, Candy Soul, and Jessica Courtney.
Oh, what's going on?
Who supplied the music for today's show. Thank you to the sound genius of Mr. Chris Hickey, who helps us produce these shows. Generous support for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer, journalist, and professor Donna Lampkin-Stevens, who fights the good fight, promoting substantive and quality journalism in an electronic age of whiz-bang and wow feature-oriented reporting. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, leaving you with the words of Ben Bradley. A newspaper is not referred to as the daily miracle for nothing. It takes the talents of a great many people, working a great many hours at the top of their game, before an editor can put his feet on the desk and accept congratulations.